Welcome to Paradigm Shifters, and I want to be, I'm very excited, in fact, to introduce Stuart Pierce. Stuart, you have a remarkable history of using or helping people of many, many higher positions and important positions in life, as well as real people or normal people, achieve a great deal by working with their voice. And also with your own intuition and with your own angels and so on. And you're pretty well known out there as someone who takes tours to Egypt and so on. But your latest book is The Story of Diana. And boy, it is outrageous. I would like you to give it the exact title since I'm having technical problems. I have to flip my book a bit here.
It's Diana, the Voice of Change.
Now, this is really something. Her death was so tragic, but her whole experiences in her position in royalty, but her whole life is something that has continually radiated at a higher and higher level, which is something a lot of us aim to be, do and be, is it not?
I believe so. You know, that's the fundament of why she wanted me to write this book. And when I speak this, I really mean over the last 3 years, you know, and obviously I wrote the book in conversation with my agent, in the sense of my literary agent said, well, you once worked with Diana. Now, the point was at that time, 3 years ago, before I started writing, that I had a confidential relationship with Diana because I joined her during the last 2 years of her life. So in other words, for those people who can remember, and it seems that many do, that Diana had just made the BBC Panorama program where we see her say, there are three people in this marriage, and another of other rather revealing things, which of course were considered to be tendentious for the royal family. However, she revealed. And as she looked at that video and didn't like what she saw, the way that she was coming over, she realized that she had a greater vision of herself. And so that's why I was sought out by somebody that mutually knew us. And when I agreed to working with her, I said, I want us to have a completely confidential relationship because I don't want to be associated with the circus that's mm-hmm. around you, with all the paparazzi,
tabloids, and the, yes,
et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, she was just so wonderfully alive and vital and curious that she agreed in the intrigue that we would have a clandestine relationship. So I never went to Kensington Palace. She always came to my studio. You know, and whenever she needed a session, she called me via cell phone because, fortunately, at the end of the 90s, we were just beginning to use cell phones. Mm-hmm. So we had this completely confidential relationship, and I swore to her that I would never reveal any of her substance in the way that she shared herself with me, because she had been traumatized, betrayed by so many people like me, like you, who had worked with her as a counsel, and then when they finished their contract with her, they'd gone to the daily newspapers and sold their stories for vast sums of money. So there were these psychic scars in her field. And I swore to her that this would never be the case, that the only way that I could work with her was through implicit integrity. So we agreed to this. However, when there I was having this conversation with my agent about writing my next book, and she said, well, wait a moment, you worked with Diana. And I said, yes, but I'm never going to write about it. And she said, well, wait a moment, the book that you will write will be very different from all the other books, because your book won't be a chronicle or a diary. It won't be a kiss and tell. You will write a book about the soul connection you had with Diana. And Diana came right in.
How good.
And showed me the whole of the book.
Oh, she did.
And so
how wonderful.
All I needed to do was sit down and write it. And so I took 5 months off the busy, you know, world schedule of going around working with people. And I was here in my study where I am now in London. And she was with me for 4 months. We had a party. Hmm. It was so enjoyable. She is such an extraordinary human being. And so we worked together so that I could be faithful and honest and true to her message, not necessarily as she was, but as she is now. And that's really, you know, what we're talking about in the sense of the fact that now that she is in spirit and has been for 2 years, 22 years, that she's reviewing her life and trying to put into perspective all the major key principles of her life, that she acquired, that she already knew but needed to remember, mm-hmm. and how this will be useful to us now in the arousal of the divine feminine on our planet.
Can I interrupt? I just want to interrupt with one comment on your book, which is that Diana's, how you have written it, and I'm just saying this to honor both Diana and you, is how you've written it is to show that incredible ability of a soul working through her personality and working through her intentions and her goals of being compassionate and loving. It kind of ripples through. I feel it in my body as you're telling these different aspects and how it ripples through all the people that she meets. It's not that she's going out and changing them, is her frequency is growing and rippling through. I love that. I'm going, wow, I just really love this story. It's not a story.
Well, that's beautiful. That, what you've just shared with me is absolutely, I'm so touched. You know, and I know we have it in recording, but if you could write that, that would be just so beautiful because you get it. You get exactly what we wanted, what she and I wanted the book to be, you know, that there's this transmission. So when she was talking to me, I breathed what she was saying into me and wrote it as the rhythm of what she was, of how she was speaking.
I could feel it. Good for you.
Like a prayer or spelling or like an incantation. But it was Diana's voice. But Diana, as she is now, as an angel of vast luminosity, because obviously the Diana that we knew, the human, was immensely sensitive. And so therefore, she was very subtle in terms of the way that she used her breath. And you'll see in writing, I'm sure you'll recognize what I'm saying, that some of the cadences in the writing are extended. They require a lot of breath. I'm going to record it as an audio next week. So
oh, good. I'm glad. I'm looking forward to that.
I'm ready to use my voice. And I know that she'll come through. I mean, I can feel her here right now. And she laughs all the time. Which I guess is leading us to, you know, the whole substance of why did she die and what happened, you know.
I want to ask one thing, which is just maybe a sidebar, but you work with the voice. And one of the things we talked about before in a prior interview is that each of us has our own special voice note, our own special, I guess our whole purpose for being comes through that voice. Is that right?
Yeah, this is the song of our soul.
The song of our soul. So I feel this, that in the book, the song of, and I'd love you to talk about that, but we wanted to talk about Diana first, but the song of her soul got, because she was saying, some of her quotes were that she wanted to be compassionate and loving and human-oriented, not just be in the rituals or the constructions of the way the power structures are, but she really carried that in her voice. Would you say that? Did she carry it from the core of her voice?
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, I mean, that was what's so ravishing about Diana, that she was so utterly real. And although, as you're saying, she responded to the constructs of being successful in 3D, that she wasn't of that ilk, you know, she wasn't of that order in the sense that she found learning very difficult. She found the sort of social aspirational aspect of so many of her peers to be fruitless and superficial. She was looking for something so much more deep. So she was still, you know, in this dance with 3D and all of the mores and so forth. But at the same time, she had this exquisite vibration, this exquisite note to do with her extraordinary love, you know, this gentle, fragile, vulnerable, but immensely bright light within her. So, for example, when I met her, obviously we all knew who she was because she was the most photographed woman on the planet at that time, and still in, you know, the most photographed woman in recorded history. But when I met her and she grabbed hold of, I met her in a restaurant, in a private room, having lunch, and she grabbed hold of my arm and the look in her eyes, these blue eyes, and she said, "You will work with me, won't you?" You know, I fell in love. I fell absolutely in love with her beauty, with her gentleness, with this soul that I could see was old, mature soul, but just having great difficulty fitting into all of those constructs, you know, the British royal family. I mean, God bless the Queen and all that she's done, but there's an emotional rigidity there, and that was not a happy playground for darling Diana.
Made me chuckle that she's funny and she had a lot of humor, because to me, that's what saves us. It saves us, right?
Hysterical. I mean, we would sometimes laugh and forget what we were laughing about. We were just enjoying laughing. Oh, it would just be hysterical laughter. She was an immense joke teller and was always finding the funny, you know, would always see the funny, never at anybody's expense, but always in amplification of the absurdity of the moment. Oh, no, she was hysterical. I mean, there's a very naughty line, which I don't often share, but you probably remember the photograph. This is when Charles had announced that he was having a relationship with Camilla Parker Bowles, and Diana appears in this black cocktail dress with a very, very low décolletage with the Spencer choker. It's a very renowned photograph. Well, she was with me only, I suppose, an hour and a half before that, because I can always remember getting to the end of the session and her saying to me, "What time is it?" And I said, "Oh, darling, it's whatever I said, 5:30. "Oh, my gosh, I've got to go and get dressed. I've got to go to this reception." And as she was leaving, you know, because she came to me from her colonic irrigationist, and from that, before that, she was at the gym. So she was just in gym clothes, and she said to me, "Nobody's going to know I've been to have a colonic." How funny she was. I think she said as she skipped up the stairs, you know, "Nobody's going to know I'm shitless," you know. She was just so amazingly ordinary for somebody who is held in such high esteem as the Princess of Wales, the people's princess.
But she also put compassion in one of the highest. From the sounds of your book and from anything I know, she put compassion and humanity way higher than all those little ritual things and people's uptightness and so on, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. But this was not necessarily something that she had in the forefront of her consciousness when we first met, because she was still trying to fit in. And when I pointed out to her that she was always never going to fit in, that she was a square peg in a round hole or a round peg in a square hole, that she wasn't part of their vibrational frequency, and what we needed to do was to determine what were her hierarchy of values, what did she want to do in the world, and this is when she dreamed up the notion of, "I want to be a peace ambassadress." She was already in the flow of that. You know, many of us didn't know that whenever she wasn't engaged in royal duties, she would just get in the car and drive to a hospital and go into reception in the hospital and say, "Is there anybody that I can sit next to?" Can you imagine the shock of receptionist in the hospital in the evening with the Princess Diana coming in looking exquisite in the way that she did? And sometimes she was very naughty. She'd say to me, "I'm so bored. Let's go and do something crazy." And so she put a wig on, you know, and we'd walk down the street near to where she was living. And we'd go to the cinema and nobody would recognize her because she would be wearing a long black wig with sunglasses or something. And we were always giggling, you know.
Aww.
But yes, I mean, her compassion, her charitable status was something that she was already doing. What I helped her do was to formalize it, meaning to become aware, "No, look what you're doing. You're doing extraordinary things. And it's your anointing. This is you are an anointed one. You are a special one. You are chosen. Your destiny has revealed this because your suffering has been so untold in its richness that there must be a reason why your soul chose this path, to become aware of the sensitivity of other people's when they are in travail, when they are suffering, because you can look at them and they can see you are empathizing." She had a charge, you see. She had a radiation. In journals that I wrote at the time, I rediscovered when I started writing the book. Mm-hmm. And so this is 20 years later, you know. And I discovered people that I had been with her seeing or that she talked about. So I went to see one or two people, and they still remember that when she touched them, They said an electrical charge moved through them that they can still feel. And it was almost as though they moved into spontaneous healing, because many of them were in hospital or in a sad state. Wow. So she was an anointed one. You know, she was very, very, very specifically chosen for the compassionate path. So she was many things. And unfortunately, society made her out to be stupid. She was not stupid. She was just feeling and thinking in a very different way from the paradigm of intellectualization, cerebralization, and doing.
Yeah, what was that? I was reading about her being immature. She was called immature and psychologically unbalanced. And I chuckled and went, yeah, isn't that what they use for people who are kind of real, sort of real in themselves and dealing with emotional stuff on the external and not just hiding from it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And of course, it was just a repudiation and a rebuke of her untold sensitivity. And it's true that in the early days, she was at her wit's end, because she, you know, she obviously brought two boys into the world very quickly. It was easy for her to get pregnant. It was easy to go through her gestation. But post giving birth to both William and Harry, she experienced really complex hormonal issues.
Uh-huh.
And that led her to that postpartum madness that we know sometimes happens, which meant that she was really, really sensitive. But at the same time, her husband was not lying next to her, comforting her. Charles didn't know what to do with this immensely volatile emotional being who was feeling so many things. He's also extraordinarily sensitive, but he has a way of being able to, I suppose, what we would commonly call push it down. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of tears into whatever part, deeper recesses of his being. Whereas Diana had to express, otherwise she would have internally combusted. So she would often spend time just weeping, you know, and we would just sit together and she would weep it out. And then we would laugh and then we put all the pieces together and make sense of it all.
And isn't that the process or the path of many who are highly empathic or highly intuitive?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, we're learning more and more and more about those people who are at what we define as Asperger's syndrome, mm-hmm. or borderline autism or fully autistic. I know that, you know, myself, I had a very similar path. So I suppose this was in the early 50s. But, you know, I believe that if we had the information that we now have, I would have been referred to as being Asperger's. So I went through very similar challenges. And I've always had a robust belief in something within me, although the world was saying that I was no thing because I couldn't learn in the conventional way. I was severely dyslexic and synesthetic, so I could see sound but not read it until I was 14, and through the ingenuity of my extraordinary mother, was able to find ways of being able to, you know, do the basics, the three R's, writing, arithmetic, and reading.
Did you use your voice as the major, besides your mother, who, well, I'm glad she was so wonderful. We need that. But did you use your voice as well, and did Diana use her voice to find her real self as a tool, like through all this confusion or emotional stuff and so on?
Yes. I mean, the story that I shared with her was that I spoke about what I was feeling and seeing as a child, mm-hmm. to discover that most people didn't know what on earth I was talking about. And I was also in touch with the multidimensional universe. So I talked about seeing angels and fairies and dead people, you know, people called ghosts. And this was repudiated. So I was locked into a psychiatric hospital at one point.
Oh, my gosh. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Compassionately was seen. Well, for me, it was all an awakening process. So it was traumatic at the time. But now I see what an extraordinary journey, because this wonderful woman who was a child psychologist, you know, pediatricians, came in and said, this child is not mad. This child is hypersensitive.
Good for her. Wow. Hmm.
I decided, well, okay, so I decided, okay, I'm going to self-mute. So I didn't speak for 2 years. And that gave me, well, I mean, what was the point of speaking? Every single time I spoke, people disagreed with me or said it was rubbish. And so I shut up. And that gave me an opportunity to learn stillness and to observe. You know, I was a very speedy, hypersensitive child that was constantly reacting to stimuli. And so this gave me an opportunity to find the stillness. And that, by the way, was the first deal. That was the first exercise or discipline that I encouraged Diana. Now, she was physiologically very awake. She loved her body. She always wanted to be a dancer but was too tall. But she, you know, she swam every day, which was really good for her as an empath because the water dissipates the electromagnetic charge of feeling.
And she's a Cancer, too, isn't she?
She was Cancer, yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, she, you know, she went to the gym every day or every other day. She loved working out and just strengthening, very gently strengthening muscle. So this brought her to a position of confidence so that she could feel her sensory capacity, her sensuality, which was very important for her because, after all, the man that she loved didn't desire her. And she was a woman, you know, a beautiful young woman who wanted to be made love to, both, you know, in terms of sentiment and also from the physiological aspect of husband and wife. And Charles couldn't do that. And that's why she sought love elsewhere, but very, not impetuously. She was very, guarded, you know, and had, as we know, she had two passionate love affairs and one that was unrequited. They were all very, very, very well managed, including the relationship that she had with Dodi Al-Fayed before, you know, whom she was with when she died.
Was that a deep love?
No. She adored him, but he was a playboy, and she knew it. He was extraordinarily kind and gracious and loving, you know, but he didn't want anything from her. He was just loving for love's sake. So it was very unconditional.
Oh.
And, you know, it was a very easy flow between the two of them. They were both lovers of beauty. They were both lovers of the slightly sybaritic activities that we can get engaged in. You know, beautiful yachts, water, sunbathing, swimming, the occasional glass of champagne. You know, they were great, great life lovers. And that's really what that relationship was about. He was so respectful of her. He was such a gentleman. That's what I loved about Dodi.
And so you got to know him as well, eh?
Yeah, I mean, I knew the family. And so his sister had worked with me quite consistently. Mm. And so I met them socially, you know, because when you work with people like this, they often trust you to such an extent that they invite you into their social presence.
That's
so I was actually able to meet and see what sort of man he was. I mean, Papa, unfortunately, was very emotionally unintelligent, you know, was just sort of responding instinctively in a very reactive way all the time and would often become hysterical, as we saw at the death of both Dodi and Diana. So it was, they were having fun. They were two young people having fun, but she certainly wasn't pregnant.
And did she talk about that sort of thing from the other side? Did she make different sense of it all? And she must have seen him on the other side, eh?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah. Well, the interpretation of soul conduct, now that it is beyond flesh, is a very, very high level vibration. So all of the connections that I receive, you know, there are many people around the world who are so-called Diana mediums, and a number of them have been in contact with me.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're really doing is rehashing the conversation that she had when she was alive on Earth.
Hmm.
And, you know, it seems to me, God bless them, but it seems to me to be purposeless, because actually the conversation that she's now having in spirit is not full of revenge. marriage is not full of regret, is not full of bitterness, is not full of, you know, the things that they're making out that she is. She is in a vibration of an infinitely unfolding creative possibility full of love and joy. Hmm. So she is an angel of vast luminosity that is working with the pantheon of the divine feminine. She is there with Mary. She is there with Isis. She's there with the Magdalene. She's there with Lady Portia. She's there with Kuan Yin and Fatima. They're, you know, these extraordinary beings who are part of the divine feminine. They're there working in consort to bring about the changes that we're seeing on planet Earth. The women and the children, the women and the girls, rather, on planet Earth will write the next chapter of history. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it should be her story, you know? Mm-hmm. She's there doing all of this, which is why she's wanting for the book. The book is just the beginning of a project called the Diana Heart Path, and creating a Diana Heart Club that people, that the women of the world can become part of for three very specific purposes. Number one, to join in communion. So we come together as kindred spirits and we share. Because where do you ladies go today? You know, the sewing circles, the knitting circles, or the bread making circles are no longer happening. Mm-hmm. We're living all sorts of different values in our life today. And so it's bringing women together so that there is this wonderful communion of joy, of love, of sharing, but also to share meaningfully. To share in the sense of exchanging what our challenges are in the world and how leading edge technology, spiritual technology, can be used to assist the transmutation of darkness. Mm-hmm. And the movement into opportunity. And the third thing being that we work on the whole process of the collective arousal of the divine feminine, and through being the change we want to see, through prayer, through affirmation, through meditation, we will come together as large groups of people, as large groups of men and women, but principally women, to share in Congress how we want the world to transpire and develop and evolve so that unconditional love and oneness is the prime objective.
Mm-hmm. And I notice in the book too, it's like at the front of this, it's a kind of movement or moving the fields and frequencies, she just cleared and transformed a lot of herself. And I feel this becoming and becoming and becoming, which is one of my favorite lines, is something that she's doing still, becoming and becoming and becoming and radiating, sending that energy into the collective for all of us to become freer, to be women, or to be expressing the feminine.
Yes, yeah, and we see it happening, don't we? We see it happening in relation to the arousal of mindfulness, this extraordinary project that Oprah and Prince Harry are engaged in to bring the substance of mindfulness to the forefront of our consciousness so that people who are afflicted by chronic depression or by dementia praecox, you know, schizophrenia or whatever, you know, that it's 1.4 people experience mental illness, you know. So
that's ridiculous.
I feel that she's helping that, the extraordinary activity that's taking place in relation to the salvation of refugee children around the world, because obviously the refugee crisis is just beyond its limits, you know. #MeToo. I mean, I could list, it goes on and on and on and on. And of course, we're seeing these remarkable women stepping forward. Jacinta Ardern, who is the Prime Minister of New Zealand, the President of Yugoslavia, that's a woman. I'm working with a woman at the moment who possibly will become the first President of the World Economic Forum. You know, it's been a stronghold
of
the male. Wow. The last 18 years. You know, I mean, it's, I could go on and on listing these amazing women that are stepping forward. Mm-hmm. Hope that the United States of America inherits the first female president, you know, in the form of Elizabeth Warren, because obviously Marianne has left the race, is now looking at other possibilities of being useful.
Well, she has been useful as she goes, hasn't she, Marianne?
Just extraordinary. I mean, she was... She asked me if I would help her, so I did.
Oh, good.
And it was extraordinary what she achieved, extraordinary.
Wow. So that's exciting for you that you get to roll along with these wonderful women making a difference, huh?
Yes, I mean, I work with change makers and thought leaders. It seems to be the role that the divine wants me to fulfill. So I just throw the energy out there, and it happens. You know, I sort of meditate, and suddenly the wheel of fortune turns, and I have this wonderful opportunity, like this book, which is just one of the greatest elements of excitement, of glee, of delight, of real truth and integrity. There's a very deep conversation that's being evoked by the nature of the book, and it's one of the greatest thrills that I've ever had, that it can be a wonderful formula of service through love and through compassion and through empathy to bring us all together. You know, one of the things that Diana shared with me this morning in meditation was, you know, it only takes 11% of the population to change mass consciousness. Apparently, this is social science. Come into the forefront of my thinking as we share now. But that's something she said this morning. Isn't that amazing? It only takes 11% of the population to change mass consciousness. So if we can bring whatever 11% of 7.9 billion people is together into consort, I believe that, you know, actions such as this book, I mean, it's very interesting watching its growth. It sold 10,000 copies in a month.
Wow, wonderful.
It's an international bestseller on Amazon, you know. So I want to keep promoting it as such, you know, so that more and more and more people acquire it and read it and love it and reread it and use the exercises.
You talked about exercises, chapter two, when you were talking about the kind of work you did with Diana. I just listed some of them. I don't know if I got them all. Healing energy and mastering empathy. I am excited about mastering empathy because it's something I'm fascinated by. Because people are going around saying, "Well, you know, I'm an empath. I'm an empath." I'm going, "We aren't using it well. That's the problem. We need to use it really well." And so I thought maybe you'd like to talk about how Diana's handling that, or how, you know, what that meant to you and her.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that, you know, today our sensitivity is being registered as empathic, whereas often we're talking about sensitivity.
Well, that's true, yeah.
And that, you know, and that an empath is someone who's been able to harness the force of deep feeling, of sensitively identifying with someone else's suffering or dilemma or ordeal, but sits in a position of holding, meaning of just holding that person with love, with grace, with compassion, with empathy. And one of the things that was really significant for Diana was that her level of sensitivity meant that she would often sponge up energy from other people or indeed from situations. And she had very few energy boundaries. And so there's a very large section in the book in chapter two about developing energy boundaries. And when she'd started doing this, both physically and psychically, automatically she was her radiance increased.
That's what
because
I'm
what we
thinking, yeah.
what we noticed, you know, being a public figure, there were many projections into her field. And some of them were very dark. And so I would often, as a psychic, I would often see these beings, these elemental beings, nibbling at her field. And so I would work through, I suppose the easiest way of putting it is through exorcism. I'd work through, you know, supernatural purposes to remove these creatures that were eating her field so that she would feel suddenly this immense influx of energy, which is when she really started to develop the science, so to speak, of her radiance. And one of the first things that we did was to spend a tremendous amount of time just being still and feeling how all of her senses were heightened when she was in stillness, and that how stillness is this immensely powerful energy of the divine feminine that allows us to feel that we're protected by the infinite beings of the universe, of the cosmos. This was one of the first things that we did. And I've already talked about the strength of her body, how she loved her body and how she loved working her body out. So she was, you know, she literally felt the musculature of her whole being externally, internally, and was constantly receiving massage, colonic irrigation, reflexology, meditation with me, chanting, to receive the holy vessels of the universe so that she could feel her radiance becoming greater and greater and greater and greater.
I love that part.
Yeah. And then, of course, the third chapter is the acknowledgement of the Anointed One, that she was an Anointed One. And, you know, one of the things that she said to me when we first met was, "I want to be the queen of everybody's heart."
I love that. I saw that quote. That's great.
You know, it sounds so beautiful, but mm-hmm. What does it mean? I said. And she said, "Well, oh, it's a good question. What does that mean?" And so she just vindicated herself by saying, "Well, I'm evidently not going to be the Queen of England, but I'd love to be the Queen of everybody's hearts." So I said, okay. Well, you know, right in the very heart of the consecration, known as coronation, there is an anointing ceremony. And I feel that what we need to do is to recognize that destiny has placed you in the role of an extraordinary person, as I call it, an anointed one. Mm-hmm. And so what we need to do is to go through that consecration. So I've annotated this in the book, the 7 degrees that we move through. Now, all of these energies, because they're all attitudinal muscles, they increased the passion of her peaceness, her peace ambassadressness, of her charity, of her compassion, so that she was able to live all of this and protect herself from all of the thought forms that were projected at her.
Do you think that if it's about building up your own and all these wonderful tools you were explaining, it's building up your own resonance and radiance in such a way as they don't have any way to hang on? Is that these beings?
Yes. Exactly. You become so vigilant of them, you see. I mean, how did Obama get through 8 years of administration, you know, where he was loathed and castigated purely because of the color of his skin?
And still is, for heaven's sakes, even though everybody loves him.
And we saw him move through with such grace. And, you know, whatever his policies were, I mean, you know, his conduct was just exquisite and supported by a beautiful woman in the form of Michelle.
Mm-hmm. Who also has that, doesn't she?
Yes. And that's obviously, again, they're both chosen, aren't they? Because otherwise they would not have been in those roles. And of course, we know that she grew into the role reluctantly, mm-hmm. but then, which she's written about in her book, Becoming. But then once she saw the purpose of her role, she simply started to craft the essential responsibilities of how she could generate influential energies that young people would aspire to.
I love that. And also, you know that, I guess we don't want to talk politics, but I do know that that time has been pivotal for all of us to generate some evolution. It hasn't, even though it's been a dog's breakfast after.
After the Obama regime.
Yes. After all that grace, we've kind of fallen from grace in a certain way, but I think it's all perfect in the sense that it's shaking us up and making us rethink and re-radiate, or however we want to put that.
Yes, I totally agree. And I find it very interesting that astrologically, Mr. Trump's ascension into office was almost a mirroring of the very complex astrology that took place in the end of the 30s, principally 1939. I mean, the day he became president-elect, the configuration of astrological influence in our lives in 2016 was almost a mirroring of what took place on November the 9th, 1939, which was Kristallnacht.
Oh,
that's really what began the Holocaust. You know, 45,000 Jews being exterminated in the German cities. So there's obviously, we're going through so many cosmic cycle interloops.
Mm-hmm. But we can learn from that. We don't have to replicate the entire thing, do we?
I feel that that's why it's come back, because mm-hmm. it's karmic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's come back because today we have transparency, whereas then it was hidden from our view because we didn't have the media communications that we have today. So everything is transparent. So there is some very powerful social shifts taking place where we become aware of our sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And therefore we shift from blind faith into visionary faith, you see, because we had blind faith that everything would be okay, and we didn't know that 8.5 million people were being exterminated. Called secret. So, you know, I feel that, for example, the internment camps that Mr. Trump and his wall have created, that many of the people that are engaged in that, because we know that there has been untold suffering for many Southern American individuals who have tried to find an easy passage into the United States and have been incarcerated, that I believe that their karma, that they're sorting out very complex karma.
Mm-hmm. I think
it's
that's
a wonderful
amazing.
Poem. Written at that time, and I won't quote all of it because it's quite long, but there's a small section which I use, which is, "Thank God our time is now, when wrong comes up at every turn, never to leave us till we take the longest stride of soul we humans ever took. It takes thousands of years to wake, but will you wake for pity's sake?"
Wonderful. One final thing, because I know I've been late starting, but I'm so appreciative of your time. But I was thinking, probably you have some comments on behalf of Diana about how she is, I guess we could say, working with or radiating into these times. And maybe I think of curling, you know, curling matches where the angels sweep the ice. Some ice sweeping for us, or some just as some sort of activation using her compassion. What do you think?
No, there, what's interesting is the fact that there is a huge collective psychic scar about her passing. And one of the main major instruments in writing this book is to heal that scar. Thousands and thousands of people are responding to my posts on social media, and most of them are in grief. I want to get to those people and to heal their loss. This is what Diana wants to do. She wants to envelop them in her arms, so to speak. We can understand more about death and release ourselves from the trauma or the grief or the horror of the fact that life comes to a close. She speaks of it as very, very simply. She said she closed her eyes here and she opened her eyes in other dimensions. But what was wonderful is that it was, and there was no weight, space, or time, and that she was surrounded by extraordinary love. Aww. And, you know, that is consistently been communicated to me over the last 3 years, that there is this just immense love. So death is not the trauma that we make it out to be.
So she got some high fives and some real love when she got there. Good job, well done, sort of thing.
Yeah, good job, well done. Exactly, exactly. And
wow.
So, of course, what's interesting is that we're receiving these radiations, but there is no interference. Because after all, the vibrational currency of this planet is the binary system of free will. So it's up to us to make choices. And, you know, all she does is to amplify the energies that we humans consider to be exquisite. Love is all there is. Expansion,
all there.
Delight, joy, freedom, compassion, empathy, do as you would be done by. All of the essential precepts that she wanted me to write in the book, these were the precepts that allowed her to live a life of pure virtue and be less chaotic in the feeling responses of deep and consequential sensitivity.
It's a wonderful book. And tell me this, does she still use the same note, or does that note change?
You mean in terms of her voice?
Yes, in terms of her, like, I guess, essential.
Well, when I feel her, I hear and feel and see very, very similar vibrations from how it was when she was here.
Great.
But now they're really expanded.
Wonderful.
So it's almost bandwidth has been amplified. I say it's almost as though, I'm sure that this is true, it's just in human terms, it's odd talking about it, but her bandwidth is now vast. And she's an angel of vast luminosity.
Wow.
And wants to work coherently with those people who wish her to be there, so that we can embody love in the way that she embodied love, not talk about it, mm-hmm. not ideal, you know, get caught up in the idea of, oh yes, unconditional love is the most pure thing that we have. No, she wants to really, 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 really feel it.
Mm-hmm. She wants us to be it, right? So go ahead.
To be it, yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. To somatize it, you see, rather than just to live in the head. You know, I mean, so many of us live in the head. We need to get out of our heads and get into our bodies, start feeling these things.
Stuart, it's been wonderful, and I'm very honored to be speaking with you, and I feel connected to Diana as we talk as well. It's very touching for me.
That's beautiful, and thank you. You know, thank you. The more... Oh, I'm having a party. You know, the more I can speak about this exquisite work, and I'm just so honored and thrilled that people are receiving it with such beauty, and it's very touching. You know, because one never knows with a book if people are going to like it and they're not going to like it. And the fortunate thing is that people are writing me letters, emails about the extraordinary energies that they're experiencing. Those are very beautiful. So,
well, I'll add my own to that, all right?
Thank you so much.
And how can people get hold of you, Stuart? And, of course, the book, you as well.
Well, we've created a website to mm-hmm. support the book. So the website is www.dianathevoiceofchange.com. It's very easy to find the book on Amazon. It's very inexpensive at the moment. Unfortunately, not in North America just yet, mm-hmm. because Amazon has an agreement between .co.uk and .com, .co.uk, of course, being in the United Kingdom, and .com being the rest of the world, and particularly the US. And so, you know, in the fall, the early fall, September, October, there will be a launch in New York, in the United States, and then the book will be very moderately priced through a distribution company on Amazon. But you can easily acquire the book on Kindle for, I think it's $2.99, because wow. I've kept the price to be very low. And the book, you know, softback, can be acquired from amazon.co.uk, Diana, the Voice of Change.
Wonderfully inspiring. And you're delightful as well, Stuart, very inspiring yourself.
Well, thank you. So are you.
Thank you. And thank you for being a paradigm shifter. And certainly we could say that about Diana. Thank you, Diana, for being a paradigm shifter.
So she's laughing.
Yeah. And we should laugh, right? So this is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much for tuning in to Paradigm Shifters. And we'll be in touch some more.